Well, hi there, listeners, and welcome back. My name is Stephanie Safarian, and you're listening to episode 514 of the Sustainable Minimalist Podcast. This is a listener-supported show about intentional and eco-friendly minimalist living. And today is the day, my friends. Back before the holidays, I gave you homework. I told you to watch By Now, The Shopping Conspiracy on Netflix, and then send me your thoughts, send me your questions, send me your takeaways. Many of you, dozens of you, did your homework. Nice work, by the way, A plus. And today's the day where I am bringing you a conversation with the film's producer. Yes, that's right. So many podcasts and influencers in the sustainability, conscious consumer, minimalist realms are talking about the film, but I'm so thrilled today to be able to bring you a behind-the-scenes interview with the film's producer. Flora Baganall is here. I'm asking her my questions. She's giving me behind-the-scenes tidbits that, you know, you wouldn't know just by viewing. And then I am finally in part two asking your questions. So you sent me your questions and I am presenting them to Flora. Flora, so thrilled to have you on the show. How are you?
Very well. And thanks for having me.
Thank you for producing By Now, The Shopping Conspiracy. What a film. I must say, you know, I'm in the sustainability sphere, and so there's a lot of chatter about this film in that sphere. But also my neighbors down the street, they said, oh, I watched this great documentary on Netflix. Have you heard of it? It's called By Now. And so it seems, at least in the circles in which I run, that it's getting a lot of traction. I want to know, though, about your part in it. Why was this film made? How did you find yourself a part of it? Why did you want to be a part of it? Give us all those details.
Yes. First of all, it's just always so lovely to hear that people have been watching something that you've worked on. And this film in particular has just had this amazing feedback from people in all different areas who've got in touch and written to us, and neighbors likewise who've stopped me and said stuff. And it's so gratifying, but it also feels really important that films can still have that impact and cut through to people. But yeah, it's been a long journey, this project. It started for me in April 2022, I think. And Grain Media, the lovely company that put this together, a small but very successful production company based in London, and they reached out and asked if I wanted to produce it. It started as a film about waste, as a film about the problem of waste and the difficulty of quantifying it because it's often not visible to all of us. And in the process of the development, it had quite a long development period. There's a lot of journalism went into this, a lot of time spent casting contributors and looking for the right people to speak to. We realized that people find it really hard to look at waste, to think about waste. We wanted to make a film that people would watch, and they would watch from the beginning to the end, and that they would feel engaged with, and that they would feel that they could relate to, and that wasn't a kind of a lecture or an essay, but was a new way of talking about a problem that is around us that is hard to engage with. And so during that process, we started looking at the sort of way that people shop and the way that we shop and the things that we buy and the things that we surround ourselves with and the systems that have created that or enabled that to happen. And that's when the film really took off. And that's when we started to really shape this different way of looking at an environmental film that used the language of advertising and the sort of creative and visual storytelling that you get in the kind of advertising industry that's so alluring and so exciting and so successful. And we wanted to parody that or use it as a way to make the film watchable, but also to offer a kind of new perspective on all that stuff that we buy.
Just curious, Flora, prior to working on the film, where did you fall on the spectrum of caring about the planet, thinking about consuming consciously? Where were you prior to starting the film? And has your lifestyle, has your views changed since working on it?
It's such a good question. And I think the really interesting thing about the project is that even though we were a small team, everyone had a slightly different starting point for the film. And I personally came to it, I'm lifelong vegetarian and I've done a lot of political current affairs films, a lot of films that are very journalistic. And investigative in nature. And so I feel like I was brought into the film because of my journalistic background in order to drive the journalism behind the project and to give it more of a journalistic edge than a kind of just a visual thing. And so I felt that I'd also done a few films about waste before. And I felt like I was aware of the problem, but I think looking back, I had no idea how bad it was. And certainly Nick, the director, has said that he didn't consider himself a kind of environmentalist in that sense. But we both reflected a lot during the process of making the film about our own lifestyles and our own shopping habits. And when you know the scale of the problem and you start to really look at the scale, then it changes things again. And certainly from my personal sort of journey on the film, I stopped shopping at Amazon when we were making the film. And we had this game that we used to play, what was the last thing you bought on Amazon, kind of guiltily. I became very conscious very quickly of the habits that I had that were potentially wasteful. And obviously, and I learned a lot about the clothing industry, and the kind of giving clothes to charity has completely changed for me. Like, I no longer feel like I could just lunch up some kids' clothes and take them to the charity shop and feel okay about it, because I know that's sending my waste or my discarded items into an unknown system.
I watched the film twice. I watched it on release date because it was advertised to me and I was like, this is right up my alley. And then I watched it a second time once we had this interview on the books. I invited my husband watched it the first time. He watched it the second time as well. And the second time I invited my two daughters to watch it. They're 10 and 7. And I said, you know, you can watch a little bit, you can watch none, you can watch all of it if you're interested. And they sat and they watched the whole thing. 10 and 7. They were mesmerized. And I think what mesmerized them was the visuals. You said earlier that people find it really darn hard to look at waste. And yet the film forced viewers to look at waste. There were countless images of major world sites overrun with trash. It felt like a Black Mirror episode to me, if you've ever watched that Netflix show. The show Black Mirror is profound because the episodes are so absurd, it could never possibly be true. But you really married the images of, let's say, Sydney, Australia, overrun with trash, with real world images of children in Ghana playing on beaches that are covered not in sand, but in clothes. So those visuals were really hard hitting. And I'm just curious, what was the behind the scenes chatter with regard to making and including those visuals?
It's really interesting because there was a lot of talk about that. And by the way, I have a 7-year-old and a 9-year-old, nearly 10-year-old, and they both watched it all the way through too. And they keep saying to me every time I come home from the shop, they're like, "Mom, your film." I'm having to justify everything that we ever buy, even the milk. I'm like, we need milk. So the sort of initial thought was we certainly didn't want to bombard people with huge piles of trash in the first opening scenes of the film, because there was a feeling that if you, A, it's very hard to watch, and B, where do you go from there if that's what you're building up to? And we wanted to eke out the kind of impact of those images. And we knew that images like the images in Ghana existed, and we knew that we wanted to include them in the film, but we wanted them to have the maximum impact that they could. And so one of the thoughts around the kind of earlier visuals in the film was to, instead of showing things that look discarded and broken and like they should be in the trash, we wanted to show the things as they were when you buy them, and like new trainers, new phones, and the way that they shower down, and that the graphics team did an extraordinary job and all of that. And we wanted it to feel closer to the things that we buy, because one of the problems of waste is that we're often removed from the end product, or we don't directly see it, or we can avoid seeing it, or we can turn away. And it's harder to turn away when it looks like all the things that we surround ourselves with all the time. So that was one of the thoughts around it. And the other thing was that I don't know, maybe you noticed, but we gradually built up to those images in Ghana intentionally, slowly. But we also, in the early sort of the opening introduction to the film, we used some images from WALL-E, the Disney film about waste. And that was also very intentional, because it felt like if we had to show big piles of trash in the first few minutes of the film, it would be easier to show the Disney version of that to people than what a landfill really looks like, which is very unfilmic and very difficult to engage people with. And I feel very strongly, and even more strongly after the success of this film, that there's no point in talking in a vacuum. There's no point in making environmental films or films that matter if people don't watch them or can't watch them or don't feel able to stick it out. And like it or not, the way that documentaries are made now has become more Hollywood, and people's sort of standards have increased enormously, and people expect the content to be visual, and they want the content to be visual. And we didn't want to preach to a small number of people who were happy to sit through a hard to watch film. We wanted people who'd never thought about this issue or never really engaged in it to watch it. We wanted the audience to be as broad and as wide and as varied as possible. And I think the visuals really spoke to that, and it really helped with that. And it gave people an enjoyable, if that's it's a kind of odd word to use, but it gave people a cinematic experience while also dealing with a really serious and complex subject.
I really appreciate that behind the scenes knowledge there, because it sounds like what you're saying is you led up to showing those images of Ghana. And many listeners wrote to me, Amanda being one of them. Hi, listener Amanda, said that the images of Ghana and the kids on the clothes was really hard hitting. And it sounds to me like behind the scenes, the team built up to that pinnacle moment with Wall-E, with the AI. I don't know if they're AI generated.
Actually,
but
I definitely want to talk to you about that separately, but finish your point and then I'll jump in on the AI point.
Okay, the images that some human being created, you built up to that climactic moment of our trash and actual humans actually living with our waste. But go ahead to your AI point.
Just before you say that, I just wanted to finish on the Ghana point, because those images are really shocking. And we as a team, it was the last thing we filmed. We'd already been to LA and New York, and we'd already done some filming in London, and we'd already started the edit. And the Ghana shoot came at the end of the process. And we worked with a brilliant team in Ghana who worked really hard to put together a shoot. And we knew we were filming on the beaches, and nothing prepared us for what it was like in reality. And those beaches are exactly as, like, there's no special effects, there's no sugarcoating. It's not like if you turn the camera the other way, there's actually a clean beach or a cleaner stretch of beach around the corner. Like, it's so shocking and so prolific, and it is literally mountains of clothing. And those images have really haunted me. And even when I pick up a pile of laundry, I think about the pictures that what we saw of just mountains of clothing on the beach. It was intentional to lead up to real images of waste, to show people the kind of Disney version, and then show people that did actually exist already on Earth. But also it naturally happened that way in the film. And it seems to have had the same impact on other people who've watched it. But yeah, on the AI point, because I think it is really important to answer that, is that unexpectedly, we've had a lot of people calling it an AI film and saying that we've generated all of the graphics in the film. And in fact, like, it couldn't be further from the truth. We worked with a brilliant graphics company called Compost, and the artists there are phenomenal, but they were involved throughout the process. They came on some of the shoots with us. They took back footage that we filmed, like, for instance, in the laundrette where all the clothes fall out of the washing of the drying machines. They were there for that shoot, and we filmed the clothes falling out of one machine, and they then painstakingly recreated that and drew them and managed to very realistically build up those images that you see of waste kind of pouring out of the machines. And the same for the phones coming out of waste bins, or the kind of piles of waste like pushing through the streets. So we filmed shots in New York and LA. So we actually filmed those. They weren't generated or anything. And then they drew the stuff on top, and they manipulated the logos on the billboards and changed things in the background. It's important to say that, because I think we didn't really set out to make a comment about AI or particularly look at that. But a film that is this visual and this sort of striking takes a lot of human effort and credit to the company and to Compost and the artists who did all that work, that they worked so hard on it and managed to do something that was so slick that people thought it was computer generated. And the only thing we did use AI for, incidentally, was the voice of Sasha, who's the, I feel like you may be coming on to ask a question about her, so we could move on to talking about her. But that again, was a, Nick, the director, created her character and wrote the whole thing, but used AI software intentionally to voice it because we were parodying things like Siri and Alexa and all the other kind of robotic voices that we have in our lives. And that again was very intentional. And it was less about AI and more about having something in the film that represented the system beyond the people at the top of the chain and the companies who've created this system or fed into the system, that we wanted the system itself to have a presence in the film and to represent the sort of relentlessness of a system that is bigger than all of us.
Yeah. Speaking of Sasha and the five steps to a product optimization strategy that runs throughout the film, that's interesting to me because if you just follow these five steps, you as a corporation shareholder will become wealthier than you ever dreamed. However, the film exists to make the point that following those five steps is not benign, right? There are consequences to product optimizing. And Sasha really makes that point clear. But I really, this is fascinating to me. The fact that you had former Apple, Adidas, Unilever, and Amazon executives in the film. I'm just curious, how did you get them to participate? And have you received any pushback from these corporations?
No, on the second point, we actually surprisingly haven't, and I'll probably now jinx it, but there's always time. We haven't. We were not sure at all if we would or not. The night before the film went out, I had the conversation with one of the team members about this. We couldn't guess whether we would get legal letters or complaints or requests for adjustments from the big companies. And obviously the whole project went through an extremely rigorous legal and journalistic process that I was steering the whole time. And that was a big part of what I did. And the kind of fact check document that we had was basically a PhD in the end. We did our due diligence and there was lots that we couldn't include in the film that may be true, that we couldn't 100%, we didn't have three sources for it and all these things. So what in the film may in fact be the kind of the sort of tip of the iceberg in a sense. And there was things that we couldn't use, that we couldn't firm up, or people pulled out, or people had stories that they told us and then they decided that it was too risky for them to say stuff. In the process of making a film like that, you learn so much and you speak to so many people and you have to be so confident by the end that everything that's in there is real and true. But even if that's the case, you could never account for how big companies, especially big powerful corporations, are going to find a way to complain or crush their critics. And I think possibly what saves us in this instance is that it was intentionally broad. There were obviously some companies named and some that weren't in the film, but the idea was certainly that we didn't just attack one specific brand or corporation, because it is a system that pretty much every corporation buys into. But in terms of getting the contributors who were part of the film, again, that was an incredibly lengthy process. We spent a lot of time just talking to people from all walks of life and in all different places, people who run supermarket chains, people who run fashion brands. And in that process, we started kind of working out what the story was, but also narrowing down who might be good to actually put on camera. And it quickly became apparent that what Netflix wanted and what we wanted was whistleblowers, or people who we decided that there were lots of brilliant journalists and environmentalists and NGOs and campaigners out there whose knowledge is deeper than anyone's and who could speak on this subject incredibly authoritatively. You know, we spoke to them and listened to a big spectrum of people, but the contributors we wanted in the film, the voices that we wanted to focus on, were people who had been in the system themselves as high as possible, who'd been part of contributing to the problem and had some kind of change of conscience or decided that they wanted to speak out about it from their perspective. Because partly that hadn't been done and that felt like a new and interesting way to tackle the issue, but also it felt like the way that the closest we could get to the sort of source of the problem. We had a casus of about, I think, around 15 people, and that then got cut down again to the people that you see in the film. And the sort of star of the show, Maren Costa, the former Amazon employee, she was found by the AP through some of her social media posts. And I remember Esme calling me the night that she'd spoken to Maren. She'd had a research call and it was Pacific time, so she did it in the evening. And I remember her messaging me and calling me afterwards, like quite late at night, and saying, like, oh my gosh, you have to speak to Maren. And she just couldn't like get enough of the conversation and tell me all this stuff that she'd heard from Maren. And again, when we actually did the interview, it was like, I think, 3 hours of a team of seven of us with just hairs on the back of our neck, just listening to her talking. And she's a natural speaker anyway, but her story was really extraordinary. And she was so good at articulating it and also so willing to be honest about the process and what she'd experienced. And I think that really made the film. And you can't ever guarantee that when you, even if you've set somebody up, until you really turn the camera on. And she was just brilliant. And we were lucky to have her.
She was brilliant. And she, her story was so compelling. Amazon came off as such a villain. Listener Kim wrote that moving forward, she plans to write down everything that she purchases. Countless listeners said they cannot in good conscience support Amazon anymore. Listener Rachel wrote that this brings her back to wanting to shop small, shop local. And I guess I'll just say, for me personally, my big takeaway, and it's not a takeaway because it's something I always knew intellectually, but I never felt it. Like, I never felt it fully. I knew it, but I didn't feel it, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And that take home for me personally was that, yeah, money's always the end goal, but why? I mean, that always seemed like such a hollow aspiration to have a boatload of money. What's the point of that? What I understood after watching this film was that the more money these executives make, the more cushioned they and their loved ones will be from the climate crisis that they're creating. So when that wildfire passes through their town, they have the funds to hop on their helicopter and they can quite literally escape to their second or third home, right? Like, that hit for me. And so we can't wait for these corporations to do right, obviously. And we can't wait for lawmakers to pass laws. We have to change. We have to push for those things, but we also have to change our behavior now. We have to get loud. We have to make hard decisions, just you and me, minions, let's say, in this society. It's our future, our lives at stake, because I don't know about you, but I do not have the funds to buy that helicopter to escape.
I think it's true. One thing about the film that did make me sad was the number of people who spoke up and said, oh, I'm going to change my shopping habits. I feel so bad. And this film's made me feel bad about what we do. And I feel so guilty about Christmas. I heard so many people saying that. And in a way, we didn't want the film to be primarily targeting individuals or making people feel guilty. The primary audience for the film was, you know, corporate responsibility and the people who work in corporations. And we quite like the idea that maybe there were some other Murrans out there who had thought about doing something or had tried to speak up but had backed down, who might watch the film and feel that they had some agency and some courage to keep going with what they're doing. Because change from somebody at Murran's level or speaking out, it does count for a lot. And I know that she's still working really hard on kind of workers' rights and trying to give people a voice within corporations. So that is one place where I think change is really possible. But workers within companies do have or should have the power to influence the companies they work for. And I'd love to see more of that increasing in the coming years. And it is important that to do stuff, because I think it makes us feel that we have some kind of agency. And I do think that individual actions and choosing certain brands and choosing certain ways to shop and things and talking about that to other people and inspiring other people to change their behaviors is also really important and shouldn't be forgotten. But I think the big question is, how do we change systems? How do we change things on a big scale? And I like none of us have the answer for that now, but I think change is for me the focus in, and making a documentary is great, and it's great that people have an awareness after watching it and engaged with the subject. The difficulty is translating that into change.
Well, the fact that the question is being asked is a major step in the right direction, yeah, right? Like, we might not have the answer yet, but it's being asked, and yeah, that's huge.
And it's not one thing. There's not one silver bullet that's going to change everything. But I think the feeling positive about change and feeling that change is possible, and it is possible, like things can change. I remember thinking, I was a lifelong vegetarian, and I remember going to friends' houses and always feeling really apologetic about saying, oh, I'm really sorry, but I don't eat meat, when they cooked meat accidentally for me. And it was like it was a real taboo as a kid. And then I remember a few years ago when veganism just suddenly took off and everyone was saying there were vegan restaurants were everywhere. And I never imagined that would happen in my lifetime. And it did happen, and it has made a change. And I think just knowing that change is possible and believing that change is possible is really important as well.
To that point, I believe it was the former Unilever executive that made the point that consumers are on a treadmill of buying more stuff. And simultaneous to that, corporations are on a treadmill of needing to extract more and more money from consumers. Like, you can't make the same amount of money as last year or last quarter. You need to continuously be making more and more. Executives cannot not show growth, right? So I'm wondering how this ends, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are on consumers just simply saying enough is enough and buying less, not buying much at all. I know here in America, there's a lot of chatter of not supporting our billionaire leaders by just not buying. That seems to me a simple act of resistance, but it can be a powerful one if a bunch of people do it. Any thoughts there?
Yeah, I think resistance is always great. I'm a big fan of silent and vocal forms of resistance. And I think there is something really powerful in collective action in that sense. And actually, I say this going back to the point of like behavior change. One of the things that has actually changed for me is that I just shop. I wasn't a massive shopper before, but I avoid going to physical shops as much as I can, and I avoid going online or clicking on anything, or even like on social media where I might be shown things to buy. And I feel like that absence actually has a huge impact on like my bank balance is much better since doing that. But also it's the easiest way not to buy stuff is to just not to go to the shop. And then you do something else instead. And that, again, feels like a really powerful form of resistance. We've been told in the UK for years, women in particular have been targeted with this message that shopping is a pastime. It's like a form of recreation. And certainly a lot of our streets are pedestrianized, and shopping is a thing that you do on a weekend or on a holiday. And it's a way to relax and unwind. And we get an endorphin hit from buying stuff. And obviously that just massively benefits the system. And it is part of how the system has been so successful, and just questioning that message, and also thinking that there are other things to do with our time, much better things to do with our time than shopping, and not turning ourselves into consumers or falling into that habit as, oh, what shall we do? Let's shop, is a great form of resistance to the system. In terms of the individuals at the top of these companies, I do think that it's true that if you took them all out today and they were all sacked overnight and replaced, that the same thing would happen again. Even though there are individuals who take more responsibility or deserve a little bit more blame than others, ultimately it's very difficult to be in that system. And that's the point the film made. If you don't turn a profit, you'll be shown the door. I think Nirav says that, the former Apple software guy. So there is a need from a corporate level as well. That's where regulation comes in. That's where creating legislation that forces everyone to follow the same rule book is important. And also where companies, and Paul Polman, who the Unilever exec who you mentioned, is a big advocate of this. And I think he works a lot at a very high corporate level on that, is buy-in from several companies. Or if you can get all big tech companies to agree to not do a certain behavior, then it's much easier for them all to do it. And I think there are more conscious ways of operating. If we have to stick with this system, if we can't throw it the whole thing out overnight, then finding ways to make it more manageable and more equitable and less accelerated, or de-accelerating to an extent, like that is better than nothing. It's not going to solve the problem, but it will help in the meantime.
I have a couple listener questions that I want to ask. Christina wants to know if you have any particular brands that you would recommend that are actually sustainable, actually care, and not just pretending to be.
Huh. I don't personally have specific brands because I tend to, at the moment, buy everything I can secondhand, or like Vinted has become really big in the UK. And I don't know if you have it there, but it's been brilliant. And I hope it long may it last and not get corrupted by scammers. But at the moment, buying when I do need something, I first get it, try and get it secondhand, or find somebody who's selling something. But I think if you're looking at stuff, like obviously we all need to buy stuff, and it's human nature to want to buy stuff and to want nice things. And even if we're buying less, it's still part of our lifestyle. So I would just say, rather than any specific brands, I would say quality is a climate issue. And so if the thing you're buying is important to you, like how long will it last? And will it last long enough that it feels worth the purchase? And that could apply to an electronic item, like a toy that's got some kind of electronic element to it. Like, how long is that toy really going to last? And will you be able to fix it if it breaks? And the same with a piece of clothing. There used to be this thing called the 50 wash test, which we were told about during the process of making the film, that all clothes used to have to be able to, it was like an industry standard. Like, they had to survive 50 washes, and they'd wash stuff in the process of making things. They'd test it out and certify it as something that would last 50 washes. And now apparently that the standard is 3 washes of that. And some items of clothing, as soon as you wash them, they change shape, or they're not the same as they were when you bought them on the shelf. And so they are essentially disposable items. So thinking really carefully about the longevity of the stuff and the fixability of it, like the materials, that's, if it's made from polyester, every time you wash it, it will shed microplastics into your water system. But if it's made from something more natural, and it's more likely to be easier on the water system, but also you may be able to fix it better, you also may be able to recycle it better. So it's just thinking about those kind of things.
Yeah. I'll just say for myself, I'll answer Sarah's question as well. The only corporation that I know that's actively and proudly doing things differently, not caring so much about that bottom line, is Patagonia. They donate hundreds of millions of dollars of profits every single year to environmental causes. They're the only brand that I know of off the top of my head that's radically disrupting the way that corporations generally do business. So for me personally, as a consumer, it's not about finding companies that are doing better, because doing better still means that they're playing by the conventional rule book. For me, it's about finding what I need from a neighbor, borrowing, accepting secondhand items, and buying as a last resort. Because when I buy, as the way the system's currently set up, when I buy, I'm playing into the system. So I try to buy almost never. It's not about finding the players who are doing it better. It's about not playing the game at all, I would say, for me personally.
And also, just to add to that, Nick Stacey, the director, often says this, and I think he's so right, is that since making the film, changed our relationship to stuff, in the sense that when you buy something new, you become custodian of that bunch of materials, whatever it is, plastics, metals, electronics and things. And we're so used to buying things and then throwing them away when we don't need them anymore, or when they break or whatever. But actually, if you think of it differently, as if once you press buy now, once you take possession of something, you are then responsible for this bunch of materials. And if we feel that we're responsible for them, then we think about it differently. And no one would want to be suddenly told you're now in charge of all this plastic and it's your job to get rid of it or to keep it. But that is essentially what we do every time we buy stuff. We take custody of these materials. And so I definitely think about that when I buy something. The reverse of that is when you take something that somebody is discarding or is secondhand, you're helping extend the life of that item, but you're also consciously helping stop that material go to somewhere where it might be harmful. So it's just a sort of different way of a different relationship to the materials around us.
Listener Jane wants to know any thoughts that you might have on lessening the personal guilt and burden of our environmental crisis when it's out of our hands, clearly, as individuals?
I think about this all the time, and it's a good question. And I think the problem with guilt is it can be very unproductive. If you carry a lot of guilt, then you also carry a lot of negativity, and that can be very heavy. And for me anyway, I feel that if I feel guilt, I quickly feel despair, and that's the kind of enemy of change. And so I guess recognizing that there's a system that is stacked against us, recognizing the fact that we're not all litter bugs that have somehow personally trashed our planet, and if only we'd behave better, that we wouldn't have any waste. Like, the whole point is that companies have intentionally and knowingly produced vast amounts of stuff that we don't necessarily need or didn't even think we wanted until it was sold to us. And so recognizing that does help shift your rage, hopefully productively, in the direction of companies and the system. And I think recognizing that to a certain extent it's out of our hands, and that we can't carry the blame for companies and the way that they operate. And I think Maren Costa says, use your rage and create action. And I think just motivating yourself to feel less guilty and more motivated and more activated to do something, whether that's collective action, whether that's writing to your MP, whether that's resisting or refusing to buy certain things, or using your power as a consumer to turn away from certain processes and seasonal stuff that's pushed on us. I think it's just finding a way, instead of feeling guilty, feeling motivated and positive about the possibilities of change is the ideal situation, but it's not always possible. And I know that it's hard. And I think that is the tricky thing about this subject, is there's days when it does feel quite overwhelming.
Yeah, this is always a question that niggles at me. I don't know if niggles is a word, but it gets under my skin, let's say, because yes, while it's the corporations that are creating the waste, and it's also that corporations are manipulating human behavior to get us to buy more than we need. I mean, Maren really made the point in the documentary that I think she called it an intentional science, a complex, highly refined science, getting the pixels the right color. That was tested. If it's this color, this shade, this hue, you're more likely to buy. Where things are put on the screen, they're manipulating human behavior at the end of the day. But on the flip side of that coin is, now that we know all of this, right? Like, we do have personal agency to change our behaviors. So yes, the corporations are responsible for the lion's share, but we have a part to play in it. I don't know. That's where I'm always...
We do have a part to play. And I think that's where, when I say there's a real joy in the resistance of not shopping, I take great pleasure in not, it's a bit drastic, but like, if we could switch the internet off, people would buy a lot less stuff. So not sitting at your computer late at night doom scrolling, where you'll be sold stuff and providing more data for more companies to sell you more things, is an act of resistance now. Recognizing the fact that every time you go online, data will be collected and used and will help companies profit more from you. And you know, the more data these companies have, the more profit they can get. And just, we can't avoid billboards when you walk through the underground in London, but you can avoid giving your attention to some of this stuff. And certainly, like, our phones are basically shopping malls in our hands. Our computers are essentially great access points for companies to reach us and for advertising to reach us. And so limiting your time in those spaces, limiting your time in shopping malls, limiting your time anywhere where you might be tempted to buy something, is a great and satisfying act of resistance that can also have the added benefit of allowing you to have a lot more time to do other things.
Last listener question comes from Sarah. She appreciates that the film ended with a bit of optimism, but she's concerned because the film did not address ways to alleviate the mess we've already created. I'm thinking plastic, whirlpools and oceans, obviously the shipping of hazardous waste to Asia. We've got the clothes in Ghana. Like, there's a lot of problems that we've already created. I think what Sarah's asking is, any thoughts on cleaning it up?
Yeah, I think there is a lot of good work that goes on behind the scenes that's uncelebrated and often boring in many ways, that doesn't get the column inches or the TV screen time that the kind of disaster stuff does. But I think we should all have faith that for all the bad stuff that happens, there's a hell of a lot of good stuff that happens as well. And that's, there's a lot of people working very hard behind the scenes to influence policy and help with cleanup operations and hold companies to account. And it's not always easy to see, but I certainly think shifting, maybe it's easy to focus on the negative stuff and the disastrous stuff and to feel very negative about things. And I think it's important to engage with what's going on in your local council, your people, local community activists. There's bound to be swap shops in your neighborhood. For every polluting company, there'll be somebody doing something really positive and exciting around the corner, and they don't always get the attention that they deserve. And so again, like, finding those things and giving them your support and engaging with those communities is a really good way to feel more positive, but also to start building towards change. And again, I said it earlier, it's like the big question is, how do we change? And how do we change on a really sort of fundamental level and not just a kind of superficial level? And I think this, for me, the solution is much deeper than just attacking corporations. It's also our political systems. It's also who has the power. And all of that is entangled with consumerism and with buying, but having faith that there are ways to change it and giving your attention, which is very precious, to projects that are good and to worthy, is a step in the right direction.
Donate your money to those behind the scenes cleanup organizations. Donate your time. They're there. Again, they might not be getting the attention, the media attention, let's say, but they're there. It's on us to go find them and support them as best we can.
And they don't have the means to reach you in the way that corporations do. They don't have the data, and they're not on your phone, and they can't message you as effectively as companies can or shops can. So you have to do the hard work of finding them, and then you should be rewarded with what you find, hopefully.
Flora, what a conversation. Tell us where we can find your body of work, but also I'm really curious, what are you working on now?
It's a good question. I finished it. I had a film out yesterday, a much smaller film, a BBC thing about bikes. And the film that I really want to make is a long-standing area of interest of mine about China and art. And I used to live in China, and I'm really keen to do a slower, holistic film that is a little bit less controversial, so to speak. But most of the work I do is very journalistic and current affairs based, so I'm sure it won't be long before I pick up another big project like this. But it takes its toll, and it would be nice. I'm taking a bit of time out to focus on something a little bit more holistic and a bit less high profile.
I can totally understand why you'd want to pivot a little bit, take a little bit of a break after this huge hit. Flora, thank you so much for your time. I so enjoyed every minute of the 55 minutes that I talked to you. Thank you so much for putting this out into the world, raising awareness, and then coming here to talk to me about it. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much for giving me the time. It's great to talk.
Listeners, that's a wrap. My friends, show notes are at mamaminimalist.com/514. Favor to ask. So this is a free episode. Maybe you've noticed I have been releasing a lot of subscriber-only episodes, and this one's free. If you liked it, if you learned something, if you took something that you're going to incorporate into your own life moving forward, I ask that you please support this work. $5 a month, or $40-something dollars a year, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or via the Substack link in this week's show notes. This show is moving to a subscriber-only model. Not subscriber-supported, subscriber-only. I am in the process, in the final days, I would say, of getting a conventional job because the podcast is no longer paying the bills. So the podcast will continue, but it will continue for subscribers only. I've been doing this for 6 years, and I simply can no longer make content for free. Financially, my family needs my income. So that's what's going on over here. I will see you next week. Please, if you loved this show or hated this show or fell somewhere in between and have some thoughts, I love to hear from listeners. It's like the best part of my day. Even if you're mean, even if you don't like me, I still like to hear from real people. So reach out, say hello, have an amazing week, and I'll see you next week. Take care.